This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Julia Jacobs. Violence in the Rakhine State, which began on the 25th of August 2017, has driven an estimated 621,000 Rohingya across the border into Cox's Bazar in Bangladesh. The United Nations rights body have called it a textbook example of ethnic cleansing, and the speed and scale of the influx has resulted in a critical humanitarian emergency. Yanti Ismail, the External Relations Officer at the UNHCR in Malaysia, has recently returned from her deployment at Cox's Bazar, and she joins me now to share her experiences of being at the centre of the crisis. Welcome, Yanti. How are you today?
I'm good. Thank you for having me, Juliet.
My pleasure. Always a pleasure to have you on this show. So I guess maybe to start, we need to kind of explain the whole situation to people who might not have heard about it. So it's called one of the worst humanitarian crises. You know, it's happened faster, on a greater scale than I think a lot of aid workers have even seen. So maybe you can tell us what sparked this whole crisis.
Absolutely. Well, the insecurity and violence in Myanmar, particularly faced by the Rohingya community, is not a new one. It's been one that they've talked about for decades already. But like you said, 25th of August was sparked the latest wave of violence that drove over 500,000 people from Rakhine State to seek safety in Bangladesh. You know, it's interesting that you were saying that aid workers themselves were observing that the scale and how big the scale of this crisis is. Actually, I've been telling this story that I went to Bangladesh on an emergency deployment. I was there to be the spokesperson for UNHCR, for the media. And, you know, I'm an emergency rookie. I've been here in Malaysia for the last 12 years in what's pretty much a protracted refugee situation where the communities are stable. You know, this is a population that's been here for a while. I've never been in an emergency like this before, certainly never at the start of an emergency like that. And I observed for myself thousands crossing the border each day, and colleagues were saying they expected thousands to cross per week, but we were seeing thousands per day. And then you could see the scale of the need. You know, people were crossing with nothing but the clothes on their backs, people requiring urgent medical care. And I observed this for myself, and I could see that the urgency and the desperate need that people had. But being the rookie that I was, I kept on expecting somebody to say to me, oh, this is normal for an emergency. This is what you always see in emergency. But instead, what colleagues who are far more seasoned than I had been saying throughout the time that I was there was that they themselves, these are people who've seen emergencies around the world. Mm-hmm. They themselves had never seen a crisis like this before. And that was quite sobering for me, because in that moment, there was a realization that I was having front row seats to one of the worst humanitarian crises of our time. And it's true. I mean, we have colleagues who are working in areas of providing emergency supplies, and they're prepared for a couple of thousand people to cross per week. But what do you do when it's a couple of thousand per day? Yeah. And it's just not just UNHCR, it's the entire humanitarian system and the Bangladesh government itself. It was at a level that nobody had expected or could predict. Yeah. And so you can imagine how it felt like on the ground, that kind of an emergency, that frenetic energy of people desperately needing help and others coming to the front to provide that assistance.
And because I know, I think Bangladesh, they used to tightly control, if I'm not mistaken, humanitarian access to the Rohingya, who have actually, they've been arriving in waves since the 70s, right? So why was that tight control there in the first place?
Sure. I'm happy to give a little bit of context as well. You're absolutely right. The Rohingya refugees had been fleeing to Bangladesh for a while. I mean, the first camps were set up in the 90s, mm-hmm. In Bangladesh. And at that time, there were a couple of 100,000 of Rohingyas fleeing violence and fear of persecution. The Bangladesh government structured it in such a way that there were two camps that are considered official registered camps, right. Kutupalong and Ayapara. And the refugees who were in these camps are considered registered refugees. And they were contained, and it was a fairly self-contained camp situation, the way you would see most camp situations. And then at some point, there was a voluntary return program. Many of the refugees from those two camps returned back, but many decided not to because they still feared returning back to Myanmar. And then many more, a few years later, came back, fleeing the ongoing violence. They found that it wasn't safe for them to stay in Myanmar. They fled again to Bangladesh. And so you're seeing waves of people who may have already been there for a while and new arrivals. And they were largely in these two registered camps. But of course, as more and more people arrived, the camps became over capacity. And so other settlements started to be set up all over Bangladesh. So it brings us to today, when you look at the crisis in Cox's Bazar, you'll see that in the beginning, it was the two main registered camps, Kutupalung and Ayapara, right, where most of the refugees were placed when they first arrived. But that very quickly could no longer accommodate the large numbers. And so people overflowed and went to all the other many, many settlements. Many people stayed in refugees' homes. The refugees, new arrivals were staying in people who were already there. And there were people who were living with the local communities, the Bangladesh communities. Mm-hmm. So right now, what has happened is that the international community and humanitarian agencies have been asked by the Bangladesh government to expand assistance to all other settlements, not just these two restricted areas. I think the policies of old were put into place at that time because it was what made sense to the Bangladesh government at that time. Right. It's certainly different right now.
And like you said, I mean, you know, like we were saying, it's something unprecedented. They've never, I mean, I don't think the world has ever seen anything quite on this scale, right?
Exactly. And at this speed. I think most people were talking about that I was there 2.5 weeks into the crisis. So just 2.5 weeks after the 25th of August, and already there were 400,000 people.
My goodness.
Can you imagine 400,000 people?
I really can't.
Exactly. Yeah. Until you see it, it's hard to imagine what 400,000 people look like. Mm-hmm. And then within a month, we had already hit the 500,000 mark. And now, like you said, it's over 620,000 people. That scale of humanity, all desperately needing help, it requires a really special kind of response to deal with that.
And how are the Rohingya community from Rakhine State, how are they actually getting to Bangladesh?
Well, the people that we talked to, the people that we've interviewed, all speak of similar journeys fleeing to Bangladesh. Many talked about walking from Northern Rakhine State, from a lot of the districts. The journeys would take typically about two weeks, if not more. People would have to cross mountains, rivers, jungles. I met old people who were not able to walk and had to be carried for 2 weeks to cross into Bangladesh. It's remarkable. It is a story of endurance. It's human perseverance. And it is a story of people fleeing to save their lives. Nobody would subject themselves to this if it wasn't because they needed to save their lives. We also talked to people who had taken boat journeys to cross into Bangladesh. Not as many as those who walked. Partly it could be because of cost. Mm-hmm. Because it costs a lot of money to have to pay fishermen to take you across. But the unfortunate reality of taking boats is that Bangladesh, the Bay of Bengal, at the period of time where the crisis was happening, the waves are huge. I mean, I could see from Cox's Bazar where we were, massive, huge waves and boats being tossed in the sea like playthings, you know. And so, of course, there were boats that capsized. While I was there, 4 boats capsized. Oh my goodness. Several dozen people died, many of them children. And it was quite sad. One case of a boat that capsized, it happened very close to shore. So the water wasn't very deep already. But because the waves are so huge, it overwhelmed the children. And so that was also a very sad part of the crisis, that even in the midst of seeking safety, you perish right at the doorsteps of the safety you're looking for.
And it's so sad. And I mean, even when you arrive, there's so much uncertainty waiting for you. What is the timeline we're looking at in the sort of like the journey that they need to take from Rakhine State to Bangladesh? What is that kind of time frame by sea or by land?
Yeah, I think by land might be a bit easier because most people we talk to cross by land. I would say about 2 weeks. That seemed to be typical. Mm-hmm. Towards the later part of my mission in Bangladesh, the people I had interviewed were talking about taking longer stops in different locations in Myanmar before crossing, and therefore the journey took about a month, but that wasn't the walking time. It was because they stopped. A lot of villages were abandoned by then. And so people along the journey were able to stop for a while and, you know, try to gather some resources or even just to gather some strength, and then to make the rest of the journey. But typically about 2 weeks of walking, but really hard walking. This is over tremendous terrain just to get to safety. And there's a river that they finally do need to cross before they get to Bangladesh. So it's not easy. It isn't easy.
Yeah.
I've been there when we saw people crossing, and you could see the exhaustion on the faces. You know, there's the relief, of course, that you found safety, but people are exhausted.
And the safety you're talking about is just safety from persecution. We're not even sure of the safety of their future quite yet, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. That's exactly it.
I'm speaking today to Yanti Ismail. She's the External Relations Officer at the UNHCR. And she just came back, actually, from her deployment at Cox's Bazar in Bangladesh. And we are discussing the Rohingya refugee crisis, which is currently happening in Bangladesh. We'll find out more after this quick break. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. In the studio with me today is Yanti Ismail. She's the External Relations Officer at the UNHCR. And Yanti just returned from Bangladesh, Cox's Bazar to be precise, where she was for her deployment to aid in whatever way she could in the terrible Rohingya refugee crisis that's happening right now. So we spoke about that terrible journey that they have to make to get there. And so let's say now that they have gotten to Bangladesh, are they actually recognized as refugees?
Well, in a crisis, people's first needs are life-saving support. Honestly, when I talk to the people that I talk to, and I talk to the aid workers that I talk to, nobody's talking about what status do you have before aid is given. Really, literally, at that moment, you're talking about people who've been wounded, people who are exhausted, people who are malnourished, children who desperately need support. It's life-saving support. What the refugees are telling us is the reason that they fled. And what they say is that they fear return. They talk about violence experienced by themselves, experienced by family members. They talk about houses being burnt. They talk about a fear of their life if they remained in Myanmar. To UNHCR, that's a classic definition of who a refugee is. We treat these people as refugees because we know that return for them is impossible right now. And the international community needs to come together and see how do we help them cope and rebuild their lives. But at this very moment, and this is still very early days of the emergency, it's only been about three months into it, life-saving measures is what people need. Life-saving support. It's emergency shelter that people need. You need basic food items. You need the ability to have clean water and sanitation, a place to stay. Families need to be reunited. You've lost family members. Many people need grief counseling. You've lost people. You've gone through traumatic experiences. I think that we can talk all we want about legal status or definitions. The people on the ground, they are refugees, and they are people in desperate need of help.
So, you know, like you said, sometimes they come with nothing more than the clothes on their back. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's obvious that they are now just solely reliant on humanitarian assistance, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that was one of the things that struck me as well when I was first there on the ground. You know, in Malaysia, we're used to seeing refugees that whose populations have stabilized somewhat. You know, they've been here for a while. So even if you're a new arrival, and many refugees come to Malaysia with nothing but the clothes on their backs, but you come into a situation of others in the community able to help you.
And some form of structure already kind of there.
Absolutely, absolutely. And support. But what happens when the majority of you are new arrivals, you know? In Bangladesh, when the 25th August crisis happened, there was already a population of refugees there. It was about maybe 300,000 or so. But now, easily, the new arrivals have overwhelmed that. The numbers are more than doubled now. And people are coming requiring help in every single aspect of their lives. And so when I was witnessing that, I was thinking about how dependent you were as a refugee to assistance given to you by aid agencies, by Bangladesh government, by Bangladeshis themselves and donors, literally down to the clothes that you wore or just the mat that you needed to put on the floor so that you could sit down. Somebody had to give that to you, you know?
Yeah.
And I could imagine psychologically what that must do to people to be that dependent and to lose so much independence. It can't be easy. Yeah.
So maybe you could explain to us, you know, as somebody who was there on the ground, you know, mm-hmm. like, so when they do arrive, what happened? I mean, because there's so many agencies working together, you know, how do you guys sort it all out? How do you even, you know, start that whole process?
Yeah.
Thinking about it is making me hyperventilate already.
Feels overwhelming,
yes,
doesn't it?
Yes, totally.
Well, at the early part of my deployment, and that was very early in the emergency, like we were saying, this crisis took everybody by surprise, you know, so nobody was quite prepared for the scale. And so in the beginning, it was true. There was quite a lot of, I wouldn't use the word chaos, but more of a struggle for coordination mm-hmm. among the UN agencies and other humanitarian agencies, the local civil society groups, the Bangladesh government and authorities. People were just trying to do the best that they could to deal with this amazing humanitarian crisis. It's gotten a lot more structured. Like one of the things that Bangladesh government did really well in the beginning was to make sure that the agencies coordinated themselves. The crisis response is led by the Bangladesh government.
Okay.
And that already is amazing because they're doing the best that they can with whatever resources that they have to try to manage this. And now what's happened is the UN agencies have come together to set up a transit center for people who've newly arrived so that you can have some emergency shelter as you arrive, almost like a triaging where the most vulnerable would get to stay a little bit longer. The ones who are able and capable would be moved to more permanent settlements. There's some kind of system in place, and I'm sure that this will just only continue to improve as the days go by. But I do want to say, though, that it's really hard to imagine what it's like when people cross. And I think in our minds, we imagine that there are rows and rows of, I don't know, military trucks waiting to help.
Yeah.
It doesn't always happen that way. Even the experience of refugees in Malaysia, I find most of the time, crossing the border into a new country, you cope on your own. You find family who are already there, you find friends, or you find your own way. And that's what I saw in Bangladesh as well. I saw refugee communities crossing sometimes in the middle of the night. They would find their own ways to whatever camps nearby. People would find bamboo. You know, people come with some money and they buy bamboo and plastic sheets and build their own settlements. There's a tremendous amount of self-help and self-reliance among the refugee communities anywhere in the world. And we saw that as well in Bangladesh, you know. In fact, in the very, very early days, just days after the 25th August influx, one of the biggest response that was required at that time were people who were most vulnerable, single mothers who with young children, people who were infirmed, people who were sick or traumatized. They were being kept in shelters, and there was a need to give them food. And aid agencies were just only trying to respond to that. But the ones who stepped up and created community kitchens were refugees.
Amazing.
They were the ones who did that first. They were the ones who responded. They found clothes. They collected clothes from each other to donate to new arrivals. They collected what little money they had so that they could buy food and cook for new arrivals.
Wow.
And I think that's amazing. And that's a part of the story, the refugee story, that doesn't get told enough.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's important to recognize that the resilience of the refugee communities are remarkable.
Yeah. Because like you said, you know, the image that we sometimes see or oftentimes see is trucks and, you know, people with their hands upright, you know, trying to take things. But we don't see that part where they're just helping each other. And,
exactly. Yeah, and that part of it that you just said happens as well. You know,
There
are structured methods of assistance from the Bangladesh government and military and authorities, from aid agencies. That does happen. But I think it's augmented by the efforts of communities themselves and their just natural resilience to find a way and cope. Yeah.
And, you know, there's something that you spoke about earlier about people coming, single mothers, you know, and I was reading stories about how a woman watched her husband being killed, all her children being killed, and she was just left alone with her little baby. I mean, how do you even start to help somebody who has been, you know, so mentally traumatized? Forget about the physical, you know, trauma that she's gone through. I mean, how do you even respond to that?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I spoke with colleagues who are working in mental health in Bangladesh, and they're talking about at this level, at this phase, as people arrive, the experts are deploying what they're calling psychological first aid. And that's really just this moment of calming people down, asking them to own the fact that they've survived and accept it, that they've survived and they're safe, and then try to give them their most try to help them meet their most immediate needs first. My colleagues who are in the mental health area said that for a lot of the time, the stress is what people go through in those early days of a crisis, is anxiety and stress of not knowing what's going to happen next and not knowing how am I going to get help.
Yeah.
If we are able to alleviate that stress and the anxiety, that's half the battle won, because a lot of the times people need information. They need to know where to go. They need to know, how can I begin to even conceive a new life in my mind, and what are the next steps that we need to take? And I think once you deal with that immediate anxiety and stress, then you can begin the process of going through and looking for people with deeper mental health needs, you know, people who may have been traumatized, who've gone through traumatic experiences, and later on to see what kind of psychosocial support that they need. It's within the response of aid agencies, mm-hmm. Looking at that, because that's a really big issue.
Yeah.
But certainly the cases of people who've gone through traumatic experiences are many. I mean, I met a woman who had survived a boat capsize. And when I met her, her husband, she talked about how she had lost her husband and her children in a blink of an eye, because she was the only one who could swim.
Oh my goodness.
And everybody else couldn't. So she said, I held on to my child's hands as long as I could in the water. But she finally had to let go because she had to save herself.
Yeah.
And so when I met her, she couldn't smile. She wasn't smiling, but she wasn't crying either. I think she just couldn't cry anymore, you know, and she was just trying to reconcile in her mind how very suddenly her life had changed. Just the day before, she was a mother and a wife, and today she had nothing. She had no one. And that's just one story of many like that. Yeah.
Yeah. And I imagine that despite all the efforts, you know, to deliver more aid and services in the overcrowding and difficult living conditions in the camps and the makeshift sites, I'm imagining that there's increasing health and sanitation issues as well.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's always a concern.
Yeah.
Let's not even just a refugee situation. I think anytime there's overcrowding,
yeah.
there's people living in extremely cramped conditions, there's always a concern that poor sanitation, lack of clean water will lead to diarrheal diseases. I did see, though, while I was there, that was one of the areas that the Bangladesh government, the Ministry of Health, together with agencies, including UNHCR, worked quite quickly and quite efficiently to address. There were several diarrheal centres that were set up to respond to people with symptoms mm-hmm. of acute watery diarrhea. And there were many programmes on the ground to prevent diarrhea. So it included hand-washing campaigns, giving people awareness on looking out for symptoms, general sanitation and you know, concern about hygiene.
Yeah.
And simultaneously, UNHCR with aid agencies and NGOs were building wells. So there were quite a few wells being built just to deal with the fact that you have an increased number of population now, and latrines as well. I think it's those efforts at those different levels that help to deal with that. It's one of the areas that people, the response seemed to be quite effective. And I think that was good. And early preparedness is it. So that was really, really good. Yeah.
Okay. And the other area of concern that I would imagine would be safety. You know, I mean, there's also the potential of people trying to get into trafficking and, you know, those sorts of terrible things that we know happens in crisis situations. Did you see anything like that happening?
Well, when I spoke to the refugee communities and I spent a lot of time talking to women, because often the stories of women tell a lot more than the stories of men would, because they have broader concerns about families and specific concerns that men may not talk about. And so the women were talking about physical safety on a day-to-day basis, not even the threat of possible trafficking or external threats, but a woman needing to get water would have to walk a few kilometres, because usually the wells that were nearest to the tents where they stayed would be contaminated. And to get to clean water, you've got to walk a long distance. A lot of these women would have to expose themselves by walking this great distance. Sometimes to go to latrines, you'd have to walk great distances, and you have to do that at night. If you want to bathe, the wells are open. Many of the wells are open, not all of them, but many are. And so if you wanted to bathe, and this is a conservative Muslim community, you couldn't bathe because men would watch you. And so women could only bathe at night. And so anytime activities are being done at night, you already heighten the risk of women being targeted. And I feared for them, you know. And a lot of the camps, the new settlements, did not have street lights. It is, I think it's being planned now to have more lights in the streets and in the camps, precisely to help with the physical safety of women. You know, I talked to some children who sometimes have to walk 5 hours per day to collect firewood. And these are very young children walking all by themselves into the forest looking for firewood. There's an obvious security threat, possibility of a security yeah. threat there as well. Yeah. And this is another aspect of security that, or safety, I'm sorry, safety that we forget about. A lot of the settlements and the places that refugees are staying, it's land that had been cleared from a forest reserve. And so there are wild animals. Mm. Yeah, the entire new site that had been set up by the Bangladesh government is called Kutupalong Extension. It's a new 2,000-hectare site. That is the site, it's a forest reserve in Cox's Bazar, and it had been cut down so that refugees could build their settlements. While I was there, three elephant stampedes happened, and families were killed. Because, you know, we've encroached into the homes of wildlife. And so that's a whole other dimension that refugees have to worry about. On top of the physical security of, you know, dealing with human threat, you've also got to deal with living what was formerly a jungle. Displacing wildlife. So then you're dealing with the repercussions of that. I think that that's a completely valid concern. And refugees themselves were really scared about that. They were concerned about the safety of their children. They were concerned about the safety of women. You know, and then let's not forget, petty crime happens anywhere. You know, even if you're not a refugee, and you'd have to contend with that as well. I think for UNHCR, what we were doing was trying to look at protection for refugees as a broad area. So you look at physical protection of people to make sure that, you know, people who are refugees aren't forcibly returned back home to a situation where they may face danger. And then while they're there in Bangladesh, that they the ones who are most vulnerable get assistance. And then trying to look at these kinds of threats that people face, and how do you reduce it, and how do you mitigate it? Yeah.
And just focusing on, you know, what you did there. I mean, you mentioned that you spoke to people and all of that, you know. So how did you even prepare yourself, you know, for getting into something like this?
I know, right? I was deployed with 5 days' notice. and that's common. That's common within the humanitarian world, that you get very little notice to go. And I think fortunately for me, the refugee situation in this region was not unfamiliar. I've been doing this for a while. I know the community, the refugee community, quite well, and because of my experience here in Malaysia. So mentally, and I went in quite prepared, knowing what to expect. And I was also expected to hit the ground running because I was there to become the media spokesperson. So I was expected to be there and start doing interviews. And I think the benefit of working in Malaysia prepared me for that quite well. Then after that, it's just to try to deal with living in an emergency situation, which unless you've done it, you probably would not be able to prepare for it sufficiently. And to a certain extent, I was caught by surprise with a lot of things that I didn't think about. Like, for instance, in an emergency, we work 7 days a week. And our day started as early as 7 a.m. That would be when my team had our editorial or content meeting. And then we would continue working all the way till about 8 or 9. And that's just my team, you know. And then you have people who are out in the sites doing site planning, looking at building roads, building latrines and building wells, and really physical work. So there was that part of it that I went in not quite prepared. I didn't expect that it would be such long hours and such long days. But you adjust, you know, you cope. And we had a really amazing leader at the sub-office in Cox's Bazar. He was the emergency leader. And he kept on telling all of us at that time, take care of each other. He didn't just say, take care of yourself. He said, take care of each other, because aid workers have a responsibility to look out for each other. If you've seen a colleague who's worked 2 weeks straight without a break, you do have a responsibility to tell them to take a break and take a stop. And that was really eye-opening to me, that your responsibility as a team in taking care of each other, beyond just reminding yourself to have a moment. And I think what I learned quite quickly was that in an emergency, you feel like you don't have the right to give yourself a break.
Yeah.
Because it's an emergency and you feel like people might die if I take a day off, which is not true. Of course, it is. Nobody is that indispensable. but that's the feeling that you get, that if I take a break, somebody will die. And I think that might be common with any aid worker. And I think that was those were the kinds of things that I didn't go in fully aware of. And now I'm so much more wise.
And I just wanted to ask you also, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, from all those stories you heard, what were maybe some that you could share with us, you know, some that maybe, I'm sure all of it affected you, but, you know, ones that stood out?
Well, like I said, I spend a lot of time talking to women and getting a sense of the unique challenges that women went through. And it was amazing sometimes. Just the weight of the world that women hold, you know. In the early part of the crisis, the first few weeks, we were seeing far more women crossing than men. So the emergency at one period was about 60% women, and not as many men were crossing. So they were single mothers with very, very young children. And that was a bit worrying, because when a single mom crosses with very young children, being a refugee in this crisis in Bangladesh, it's an extremely physical situation to be in. You need to have strength, because even building your shelter means you have to carry huge bamboo poles, cut the bamboo poles, build them, construct them on the ground to build your shelter. It's beyond the skill of many women for whom home life in Myanmar was just as a domestic, you know, housewife. You're not equipped with those kinds of skills. And so that was one of the things that I was observing, that a lot of the women were disadvantaged because you didn't have that physicality to deal with coping in this situation. As a result of it, we saw a lot of very young children having to take up the burden of being the adults, because you've got to help your mum, you know. So I saw this little boy who was maybe about 8, and I was just watching him while I was sitting down waiting for transport. And he was put in charge of firewood. So I saw him walk with the bundles of firewood, and then he had to chop it. He was just about 8. And then he was instructing his little brother, who was maybe about 5. So the little brother was following him and doing what he was doing. And it turned out that his mom was a single mother, and so he didn't have a father. And so this little 8-year-old boy became the male, the man of the house. And he's 8, you know, and he could barely carry the bundle of wood himself. But he's the man of the house. And I saw little girls who, and again, these, I would not be surprised if these were children who were from households led by a woman, because the father's lost. They'd have to walk kilometers to go and pick up ration or aid from the drop-off points. And you could see them walking and carrying, you know, it's kilograms of rice, it's lentils, it's sugar, it's flour. And these are tiny little thin kids carrying it on their heads. I saw this one girl, she could barely hold it up. It was so heavy, the things that she was carrying. And she finally heaved it over her head. And then she just sighed, you know, because, and to me, that's like a, you know, it's that moment where you're like, okay, I can do this. There were just far too many stories like that, far too many. It's such a sobering reality of the crisis, the day-to-day survival. How do you cope, you know? Yeah.
And, you know, from all the stories, from the people who did speak to you, you know, did you get a sense that they would like the international community to know something, and what would that, you know, something be?
Yeah. Actually, it's interesting that you asked that question that way, because I always felt awkward or almost voyeuristic to ask people, tell me your story.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like, who the hell are you? Like, mind your own business. But what I would say to people when I wanted to ask them about their stories is that I can't give you anything, but I can bring your story out to the rest of the world. What do you want to say? A lot of the times, people just wanted to talk about what happened to them. Actually, really interestingly, one day I was doing interviews, and I was talking to a man who had set up a little business. He just arrived and he set up a business, and I thought, oh, what a cool story. So I was talking to him about it. And I made an announcement with my translator quite publicly to the groups that were there, and I said, I'm not here to offer you anything. I'm only here to ask you your story. Would you like to talk to me? And so after I was done with the interview, a crowd had gathered, which is typical, and this woman was standing there waiting at the side, and she called my interpreter and said that I want to talk to her. And so my interpreter said, oh, Yanti, wait, somebody wants to talk to you. And then I went to the old lady. She was maybe about 70, and I said, yes, you wanted to talk to me. She says, I want to tell you my story. And I said, okay, I'm listening. Tell me your story. And so she did. It was the, you know, it's a typical story of the persecution that she faced. She had children who she's lost. She's all by herself at 70, and there's a lot of pain. And she said, I don't know why they're doing this to us. I don't know why she said that. And then when she was done, she sighed and she walked off. And that's it. She didn't want anything from me. She just wanted to tell me the story. And I thought that was remarkable, that it was such an insight for me at that moment to realize we can play a role if it is just to tell the stories of what these people go through, if it can change some views about the community. And I think consistently that's what refugees had wanted from me when I talked to them. Because I really could, I could offer them nothing. I was a media officer. What could I give, right? But I think I was able to offer them an opportunity to tell the story. And people wanted that, you know, to know what had happened to them so that they weren't forgotten, I think. And that I think that they survived what had happened and now they're there, you know?
Yeah. Because I was just going to say that, you know, it's sad that all these stories are typical. You know, none of it should be typical, but, you know, it's unfortunately that is just how it is.
Absolutely.
Isn't it?
I know. I use that word just now, the typical story, right?
Yeah.
It's typical
and
in that context.
In that context, yeah.
And it's you're right. It's sad that it's become typical. But I do want to say, though, that everywhere that I saw the stories and you know, the quote-unquote typical stories of people, the pain that people go through, and in no way do I diminish that at all. Those are all valid experiences. But every once in a while, you see a story of tremendous love. And that's also something that struck me while I was there, that there's all these dualities. Like I met this man. Remarkably, he married a Rohingya woman who was much older than him. And that already is quite unique. And I was interested in that. I was like, ooh, how did that happen? But she was pregnant as they fled. And she gave birth on the journey. So he helped her deliver. And her baby died. One was stillborn. The other couldn't take the milk from her and died. Of hunger. And she was in a lot of pain. There were complications with the pregnancy. So she told him, just leave me. Just leave me. You go. You take the other children, just go. And he says, I will never leave you. Even if I have to wait here, because they travel with groups. It's safety in numbers.
Yeah.
So everybody had left them. So she wanted him to go. She says, just leave. He says, I will never leave you. So when I met them, they were at the border and he was holding her hand and had an arm around her and he would not leave her. And I thought that was so beautiful, you know, that you can express so much love even in this moment. And then there was one of her daughters, perhaps about 5 years old. We took the mum to the hospital and the little one wouldn't let the mum go. She clung onto the mother, not because, I don't think it's because the little one was insecure. It almost felt like she wanted to protect her mum. Mm-hmm. So when her mum was lying down, you know, doubled over in pain, she wrapped her arm around the mum, like to protect. This is a five-year-old little thing. And
amazing.
So in the midst of everything, in the midst of the horror, you see these beautiful moments of a husband's love for a wife and a baby's love for the mum.
What happens now? I know there's no real solution, right? But what is kind of the game plan, I suppose, if you want to call it that?
I know, Juliet, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's actually the million-dollar question for all refugee communities around the world. What next, right?
Yeah.
The people that I spoke with weren't ready to think about what would happen next. People were just dealing with the now. They were dealing with survival. They were dealing with just trying to be safe. Mm-hmm. A lot of the men that I spoke with started talking about wanting to become self-reliant. So that means they wanted to be able to provide for their own family and look at possible ways of earning and employment. I think that right now, in the immediate wake of this emergency, everybody's focused on life-saving measures,
sure,
as it should be, because that's what people need the most. At some point, people are going to have a discussion about helping people rebuild their lives, be it temporarily in Bangladesh, and that means would they be able to have access to employment? Children need school. You know, people need regular healthcare. Structures need to be put in place. People need to start to have normalcy. You know, there are discussions going on around the world right now, well, in our region, about return to Myanmar. And that's a discussion that needs to be had. But for the refugees on the ground, they're more focused on today. Can I get food for my children? You know, can I be safe? And I think that perhaps the easiest way to cope with this crisis is perhaps to approach it that way. How do we help people now? How do we help people in the next few months? Help people get on their feet, return some semblance of normalcy into their lives. And then people are going to have to look at long-term solutions.
And just, you know, looking at the communities that are in Malaysia, for example, you know, how does all of this sort of, well, affect them in some sense of the word, I suppose, is what I'm trying to say. You know, how does this change their status or, you know, how does it affect them?
Yeah. Well, you would have seen from the press that the local Rohingya communities have been quite actively, quite vocal about what's been happening. And they're quite engaged, of course. People have got families back home and they're concerned. And, you know, I think that it's a good time right now to look at the Rohingya population here as well, because the population in Bangladesh, the population in Malaysia, one thing that they share in common is that they're unable to return.
Yeah.
Right now, that's impossible. So if we're talking about compassion and sympathy for the Rohingyas in Bangladesh, and we acknowledge that return for them is difficult, we must also accept that that means the return for those here, it would also be difficult. While I was in Bangladesh, I think Malaysians know this, that there were many, many NGOs from Malaysia there. I mean, some prominent ones that work closely with us, Muslim Aid and Mercy Malaysia, were strongly present there. And I think that's amazing. I was making a joke to some colleagues that if you see a crowd of people and you throw a rock, you'll hit a Malaysian. I'm half jokingly, but there really were a lot of Malaysians who compelled by the need to do something for the Brotherhood. Mm-hmm. They went forward and, you know, people were building bridges, building latrines, bringing food aid. And I think that's an amazing reflection of the generosity of Malaysians. And in fact, the Malaysian government itself had, our Deputy Prime Minister had gone to Bangladesh and committed the building of a field hospital. That's just typical generosity of Malaysia, you know, helping neighbours, helping fellow ASEAN countries and regional countries, and helping as well with this community that's in need. Now we need to look at the population here in Malaysia for whom life has, as a refugee, has gone on for decades.
Yeah.
And how do we help to stabilize this community as well? You know, people still don't have legal access to work. Children are unable to go to school to have formal education. And these are children who are growing up and they need to be able to be useful. They need to be able to contribute back to the society that they're in. And they need to be able to find a way to survive on their own as well. And I think that's one of the things that the crisis in Bangladesh, while it's happening, needs to make us also reflect on what we can do to help the ones who are here.
And, you know, just for regular Malaysians, you know, if they would like to help, you know, what are some of the ways that they can assist? Short of going there themselves, you know, how can they assist from where they are?
Yeah, please don't just go there. I think the worst thing you can do is just to show up and you know,
and and
not know what to do and become a burden to people.
Exactly, need aid yourself.
Exactly. But, yeah. If I could just tell a really funny story. My colleagues in UNHCR here were still getting queries from people who wanted to help. And a lot of the offer of assistance were clothes because people wanted to send clothes. You know, and they'll ask, how do I send clothes? And so I took a photo of what I saw in one of the camp areas. It was alongside the road. The Bangladesh military, I think, were building a highway. There was so much clothes donations, so much piled all over the place that the clothes were being bulldozed and made into landfill.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. I'm not even kidding you, because, you know, it's just a reflection of, in that moment of urgency, what people needed was shelter.
Yeah.
They needed food. They needed healthcare, medical aid. and not necessarily the latest, you know, designer threads. And so Malaysians sometimes very well-meaning, but somewhat misplaced at times, you know.
Sure.
Many others are doing amazing work. I'm just making a light moment. But if people wanted to help, I think that the most practical way you can help is actually to give cash donations. That's really the most practical. But be careful to whom you give it, because you need to give it to agencies you know are credible. There are some that have a reputation and you know they're delivering assistance and aid. And those are the kinds of groups that you should give to. There are far too many Rohingya group NGOs that have just sprung up like mushrooms overnight. Mm-hmm. And so be discerning where you give it. If you'd like to give to UNHCR, because we are one of the main agencies operating in Bangladesh, that's possible as well. And I think that's a simple way that Malaysians can contribute. But I always say, aside the in-kind of financial help that you can give, never underestimate the value of moral support. You know, just that moment where you and the people that you can influence take that time to understand what's happening, who these people are. They're not people who are here to take jobs from Bangladeshis or Malaysians, you know. These are people who fled because they had no choice. That understanding, that realization, and spreading that awareness to your spheres of influence helps to create an environment that's far more humanitarian for refugees, not just in Bangladesh, but wherever we are. If you believe in karma in any form, you would realize that this can easily happen to any of us at any time. Yeah. If we're not part of the solution that's creating an environment that's more humanitarian, if it does happen to us, we would be in that environment that's not supportive of the refugees either as well, you know. And I think that's something that we can easily do from wherever we are. Just that moral support of understanding who refugees are and advocating for greater protection for them.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much, Yanti.
You're welcome.
I've been speaking to Yanti Ismail. She's the External Relations Officer at the UNHCR, and we've been discussing the Rohingya crisis, refugee crisis in Bangladesh. If you'd like to help, you can head over to the UNHCR website to find out, you know, how you can provide aid or donations or anything like that. And that website is unhcr.org. This has been Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.